Today on Pilot's Discretion, we're joined by former fighter pilot and aviation medical examiner, Dr. Keith Roxo. He tells us the right way to approach an FAA medical exam, how to avoid common mistakes on the application, and flying as a Top Gun adversary pilot. Pilot's Discretion starts right now. Welcome, pilots. I'm John Zimmerman of Sporties, and thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion. If you like the show, please subscribe in your favorite podcast app, and remember, you can catch up on every previous episode by visiting sporties.com/podcast. Today, our guest is Dr. Keith Roxo. During his military career, he logged over 2,000 hours in high-performance aircraft like the FA-18, the F-16, and the F-5, including a stint as a Top Gun adversary pilot. He holds multiple military flight instructor qualifications, an airline transport pilot certificate, and is a CFI instrument. But Keith is also a doctor, board certified in aerospace and occupational medicine, and is an FAA senior aviation medical examiner. He's also the commercial operations director at Wingman Med, an organization that helps pilots connect with local AMEs. Keith, welcome to Pilot's Discretion.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the FAA medical exam, which is a source of stress for many pilots and something you're deeply involved with. What's the right way to approach this event? If I'm a regular pilot going for a third-class medical and I'm worried about it, at a high level, how should I approach that event?
So we think everybody should approach the FAA medical exam like a check ride. So it is a medical certificate, just like a pilot certificate. Unlike most pilot certificates, it does have an expiration date. But most people don't show up to a private or a commercial check ride unprepared. However, we notice a lot of people show up to their AME as if they're just going for a checkup with their regular doctor. But it is a medical examination to determine your suitability to fly. So that's why we feel people should treat it like a check ride and prepare as best as possible for the best possible outcome.
Sometimes the application is almost as stressful, if not more so, than the actual exam, the MedExpress process, which is taken over from the old paper forms. What should I do if I'm not sure about an answer there? Because this comes up a lot of times. Pilots say, well, that's maybe a yes or maybe a no. Can I reach out to my AME? Do I Google it? What do I do if I'm not sure?
Sure. There are definitely a few options. So one option is to Google the FAA AME guide. And so in the AME guide, it gives a lot of information for the AME. So that's kind of a key component. It is written for doctors, so not everybody can understand all of the details in there. But it will give you some information about the various conditions. The trick of it is MedExpress is divided up into multiple sections, and all of the sections are designed to trigger your memory about the medical conditions you have either had in the past or currently have. That's why they want to know what current medications you're taking. There's a big bold statement when they start asking the individual questions, have you ever in your life had the following? And then they want the past 3 years medical visit. So all of these things are designed to jog the memory. But in addition to looking at the AME guide, you can call an AME and try and set up what's called a consultation appointment. Now, not all AMEs are willing to do this, but some of them are. And then there are consultation services. There are several services that are out there. Obviously, we like our service. And then one thing that we have on our website is a MedExpress simulator. So if you're not ready to fill out the official MedExpress, our website does have a simulator, and that is completely free to use. So you can get a feel for what those questions are before filling out the real one if you haven't done it in a while. And then you can also have us review that for you. Now, that is a modest fee at $50 to have us review your answers.
Let's talk about that pilot AME relationship, which may be a doctor you see a lot, but may not. Maybe somebody you see infrequently. What's the right way to build that relationship? Can I talk to them about a potential issue, or do they have to report that if we talk about a medical concern I have? You know, what level of openness and honesty? Obviously, we want to be honest, but sort of where's that line as a doctor? Would you prefer a pilot calls you early on in the process, or just shows up and said this thing's happened?
So I believe that people should be engaged early on in the process, but that doesn't mean your AME is the best one to engage with. And that's because, like, not every pilot you know is a great pilot. Not every AME is a great AME. And some of them aren't interested in helping people with the preparation. And part of that is just a business structure. It takes time and energy and the knowledge to help somebody prepare for an exam. And if their business isn't built in a way to accommodate that, it's just extra work for not necessarily any extra money for them.
There's been some horror stories over the last few years about pilots stuck in the medical process for over a year. Some of it on the FAA side, it seems like. Some of it may be mistakes made by the pilot or even the AME. What's going on there behind these horror stories, and how common is that?
Typically, the horror stories have to deal with bad paperwork. So the AME, when they are reviewing a file that gets submitted to them, they are literally only dealing with the paperwork in front of them. You're not there representing yourself in front of the doctor at the, you know, at the FAA office in Oklahoma City. So they're just dealing with the paperwork. So if you show up for a particular condition, or if your file shows up for a particular condition and it doesn't meet all of the requirements to be certified, then they're going to ask for more information. And so that process takes a little bit of time, partly because there's a backlog and partly because they use the US mail system to send out these notifications to pilots. So you get a letter from the FAA requesting more information about a particular condition. You go to a doctor, you ask them to write the note based on the guidelines that the FAA is looking for. That note gets then submitted to the FAA. But if that note contains new information that the FAA was not aware of, and this is what we see commonly, mistakes in documentation, if that note gets submitted and now it highlights another condition that the FAA was not previously aware of, and the note doesn't discuss that condition to the extent that they like, that's just going to spawn another request for information. So that's how people get stuck in the process. Other ways people get stuck is kind of going back to not every AME is a great AME. And if you've left all of your documentation with the AME to forward on to the FAA, if they don't do it, your case really isn't going anywhere fast.
Let's talk about if I've filled out the application one way in the past, and then I think maybe I'm wrong the next time I come through. Should I change my answer? I've heard this is another way to get stuck in medical hell. If I answered no previously and I realize now it's a yes, do I fess up? How do I do that? What's the right approach there?
So if you answered no to something previously and you realize that was incorrect, by all means, answer yes the next time, but be prepared to have the information that may be necessary. For example, let's say you have a history of migraines. You don't have any headaches recently, or you have very mild and infrequent headaches so that you can be certified. If you forgot to answer yes to that previously and now you're going to answer yes, you have to have the right documentation that shows that you're still eligible. And that's part of that preparation mindset. If you answered yes to something previously because you thought you had a diagnosis, and then later on you're talking to your doctor and he says, oh no, you don't actually have that diagnosis. Well, then you're kind of in a weirder position, because the FAA they want to know how you're doing now. So they care more about the changes to the positive now. But when you change something from a positive to a negative, well, they're going to be like, wait a minute, you said you had migraines before, but now you're saying you don't. That's a little weird. So that also will require some type of explanation.
Let's talk about some good news in the medical world, which not all pilots may be familiar with, but the concept of conditions AMEs can issue, or CACI. What is that, and how might that be of use to me as a pilot?
So conditions AMEs can issue are a series of conditions that are deemed common enough and potentially serious enough, but also have very good historical stabilization on well-established and known treatment protocols. The trick here is going back to that preparation. So if you have one of these conditions and you have your doctor's note that specifies that you meet all the criteria as outlined in the CACI, that means that you are a very low risk to aeromedical significance. Now, the FAA is primarily concerned with either a sudden or insidious incapacitation in flight. So if you meet the criteria, then your risk is so low that your AME can actually issue you the certificate on the day of the exam. It doesn't even have to be forwarded to the FAA for review. So the AME has the full authority to issue you, but you have to show up prepared. Migraines happens to be one of those. That's why I kind of brought it up before. If you show up with the correct paperwork that says that either the medications you're taking or the frequency of your headaches and the severity of your headaches are mild enough, you can still get your medical issued at the exam. If not, then it will need to go on. Or if you check yes to migraines and you show up without the paperwork, then your exam will be deferred and it's going to take approximately 6 to 9 months to get through the process.
And how's that different from SODA, or Statement of Demonstrated Ability, which has been around maybe a little bit longer? What's that process for?
So a SODA is more for something that's permanent. A CACI is for a medical condition, and medical conditions can alter and change over time. So the FAA is almost always going to want an updated evaluation for every exam for a medical condition. But a SODA is more for something that's static. So imagine like an amputation. So if you've lost your left hand or your left arm, that's not really changing over time. So a SODA is more of a one-time prove you can operate the aircraft. And then you don't really have to do updates on that because you have the SODA. It's not like you're going to regrow your arm or something like that. Now, if you have another condition that is a permanent one, you would need to go through another SODA. Common SODAs are either for things like amputations or vision changes that are permanent and not necessarily disease associated. So more injury associated than disease associated, and color vision. Color vision is a very common SODA.
Let's talk about mental health briefly. It's a hot topic in everywhere in medicine, I think, right now, but particularly in aviation over the last few years. And there's been some news recently on this. It seems like the FAA is trying to get up to date on that. Where do you think we are with that? Is the FAA and our industry as a whole improving how we address mental health in the pilot medical world, or are we still stuck in the past?
This is a bit of a complicated issue. The first thing I'll say is the FAA is doing a lot to try and help people get back to flying as quickly as possible. Now, there are a few issues with this. What the FAA has done is they have a few of these decision tools. So they have a PTSD decision tool. They have a situational depression decision tool. So these are areas where if your symptoms were mild enough, your diagnosis was moderate to mild enough, and you have not had any significant issues recently, then the AME can issue you at the exam, kind of like a CACI, but it's called a decision tool. So that's something that the FAA is doing great. They're also have hired more psychiatrists to help with the backlog of psychological cases that they have to review, and they're looking to hire more. So those are all the good things that the FAA is doing. One of the bad things is that they still have a large backlog because they don't have enough properly trained staff to handle the volume of cases. Now, the other part is people get upset because the common thing that we hear is that the FAA won't let me get treatment, or the FAA treats mental health differently. And that is just not true. If you have a heart attack, you have to recover, pass all the testing, and follow all the guidelines, and then you can get back to flying. If you have depression, you have to recover, you have to pass all of the testing and follow all the guidelines, and then you can get back to flying. So they're very similar. People don't see them as similar because they don't see mental health as a physical injury, but they're treated almost identically by the FAA. You do have to be better. You cannot have a symptomatic mental health disorder and fly under an FAA medical. And part of that is because 9/11 has shown that aircraft can be used as weapons of mass destruction. And the German Wings crash of 2015 has shown that if you allow somebody with significant symptomatic mental health disease to fly, then there can be catastrophic results. And then John Travolta has shown that if you have enough money, you can fly almost any size airplane with a third class medical. So there's no limit on the size of airplane. We get that question a lot, but I only want to be a recreational pilot. Okay, but a third class medical doesn't limit you in size. It's not light sport. It's not basic med. It will let you fly any size of aircraft that you have access to.
Let's talk about VA disability real quick, because I know that's something you have experience with coming from the military world. And there's, you know, definitely a hot topic with military pilots transitioning to civilian flying. So does the FAA care about my VA disability rating?
Absolutely. And the reason for that is because VA disability implies that at the time of the award, you had a functional or mental limitation due to the condition. So not all disabilities are going to cause problems with FAA medicals. For example, let's say you were in the infantry in the Army, and your job is literally to carry around a 50-pound pack and a rifle and go walk around all the time. Like, that's what your training is to go do. Well, if you have a pretty significant knee or hip injury, that can be difficult to recover from and get back to that line of work. And then when you separate from the military, you will get a VA disability for some condition associated with that. But after a period of time, you can recover to the point where you're fine walking around, you can work out regularly. But what you can't do is throw a 50-pound pack on and walk 15 miles a day. So you're not fit for military service in your job, and you are entitled to a disability compensation for that. But that disability compensation is not going to impede your FAA medical unless you show up with your at your exam and you can't walk on that leg. I mean, if you show up to a medical exam with a broken leg, well, you can't push a rudder, you can't push brakes, you can't fly an aircraft. So where we run into issues with disability is when somebody has a disability diagnosis of PTSD or traumatic brain injury or depression or anxiety. So again, going back to the requirements of a VA disability, per the law, is that you must have a functional deficit due to that condition. So if you have a functional deficit for PTSD or traumatic brain injury, then that is not something the FAA wants to fly. And this doesn't have anything to do with it being a VA disability. If you were a regular civilian person who had a traumatic brain injury, you're going to have trouble getting back to flying. You're going to have to prove that you are mentally and cognitively capable of flying an aircraft before they let you back in the air. Well, that's what they want the veterans to do. If you have this disability rating for traumatic brain injury, they just want to know that you're capable of flying. They're not holding it against them. They're just making sure that they don't have a functional deficit, which is what they would do to anybody else who reported a traumatic brain injury.
Keith, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, let's talk about your military flying days.
Okay.
Earn all your pilot ratings and keep your flying skills sharp with Sporty's Pilot Training Plus. This all-inclusive membership unlocks Sporty's complete library of award-winning video courses, so you can learn anywhere you have your phone, tablet, or laptop. For one annual fee, you get access to over $1,500 in courses, a smart investment in your flying career. Plus, enjoy free shipping every day of the year at Sporties.com and apply for one of our three annual flight training scholarships. Learn more at Sporties.com/pilot training. Now, back to Pilot's Discretion.
We're back with Dr. Keith Roxo, who had a long military career before becoming a doctor. And Keith, you had the opportunity to fly as an adversary pilot at Top Gun, something that's pretty unique, I think. What did you learn about flying when you trained for that role?
Well, it's not so much what I learned training for that role in particular, but it's more the level of detail that going through the Top Gun course and then being a staff instructor. And I wasn't technically a Top Gun instructor. I worked in a sister department that we called Strike, but I did a lot of the adversary work in Fallon, Nevada during my time. And what I learned was just the immense attention to detail that they wanted. When you go to Top Gun, you're already assumed to be a good pilot. It's effectively recruiting, right? You can't just say, I want to go. You kind of have to be picked or sponsored. You can say you want to go, but if nobody sponsors you, then you're not going to make it. So what they want to do is they want to take all of those folks and turn them into, basically dust off the little edges and make everybody as sharp as possible. And a lot of it is about teaching. So they talk about it kind of in the movies where the goal really is to not just make you the best pilot, but to make you the best at teaching to the next generation. All of the schools in Fallon are what I call the graduate schools of aviation combat. And so they're making the professors, and then the professors are heading out into different locations. Some of them stay there. Some of them go to satellite schools, and they become the local experts so that as Top Gun puts out information, they can disseminate it, and everybody's following the same standardized format. And one of the things they pushed out a lot was to differentiate what was the standard versus what was technique. And so when you're teaching something, hey, this is the standard, this is the checklist because this is proven and vetted. By the way, how you do a level speed change may be different. There are a couple of different techniques that I'm going to show you. So that's kind of the big thing that I learned there was the difference between a standard and a technique and really how to make sure that in order to teach something, you really had to know it. And if you can't teach something, you probably don't know it as well as you think you do.
That's a great lesson. So many applications there for general aviation flying, I think of. It's a way to maintain the craft in, you know, our job as pilots, the technique and choosing the appropriate technique, but never sacrificing the standard in the process of doing that. Just a great mindset. How about lessons learned there for medical readiness? I mean, what did you learn flying the very, you know, high intensity environment there, high stakes environment? What'd you learn on the medical front? Maybe not so much as a doctor really, but as a pilot about that.
So what I learned as a pilot on that side was that not all doctors are great doctors. I did not have the greatest flight surgeons in my time as a pilot. They weren't all bad. But I remember going, so when I was an adversary, I did a lot of dogfighting. I mean, that was kind of my job. And so I started getting some back pain. And I didn't know how bad the back pain was, but it was kind of constant. And it wasn't going away. And it seemed like it was getting a little worse. I just couldn't get comfortable. And I went to a doc and he did an exam and he said, nope, you're fine. And I said, I'm not fine. I wouldn't be here if I were fine. And he's like, nope, everything checks out good. You're fine. And I said, look, dude, I'm a fighter pilot. I don't come to the doctor for fun. Okay. Still going on. And that was really all he would give me. It was very frustrating. And so then I had to reach out to, you know, I had some neighbors that were doctors. I talked to them. They got me some advice. And I realized that what I was dealing with was pretty common mechanical low back pain. And what he meant by saying you're fine is I don't have a significant medical issue. But he did a very poor job explaining that to me. And the more intelligent somebody is as a patient, and on the average, pilots tend to be a little bit higher on the intelligence scale, the more they want to know the details of what's going on. So not explaining something becomes a problem, and that doesn't build a good rapport with the doctor and the patient. So translate that over to my time as a doctor. I try and do a very good job explaining things to people and not just blowing them off when they come to me with a concern. And then the other thing I learned because one thing you learn as a pilot is avoid medical, right? So now both my partner Dan and I were both F-18 pilots prior to, you know, going to medical school. And what we now know is, wow, we were really afraid for not a big reason. It takes some pretty significant things to keep you from flying. And from the FAA perspective, they just want to know the details. That's really what they want to know. They want to know that you're okay and the details of how and why you're okay. And if you're not, and if you can't fly, particularly for the FAA, you probably aren't that safe to fly. Now, you may think you are, but in the realm of decreased oxygen, higher cognitive demand, you probably aren't as safe as you think you are.
Let's talk about those airplanes. You got to fly the FA-18 and the F-16. Both U.S. fighters with long histories, but with very different personalities, or at least it seems that way. I certainly haven't flown them. How would you describe those two airplanes, the differences between them?
So they are actually remarkably similar in terms of their overall size and mission set. And I'm talking the Charlie Model Hornet, the older one. The Super Hornet is significantly larger. But they are different in terms of their baseline capability. So the Hornet was more known for its ability to point its nose and high angle of attack capability, whereas the F-16 was more known for its ability to maintain its energy in a turn versus the ability to point its nose. So it does have a little bit of a different style. But what I learned from flying them is that if you take them in an equal configuration, the Hornet wasn't very far behind in the energy capability standpoint, but it still had a good, you know, nose authority standpoint. But when you started loading up pylons and simulated bombs or fuel tanks, the degradation in performance on the F-16 was significantly greater. So that was one of the big things that I noticed.
And what's the most G's you ever pulled flying in Top Gun?
9 G's. I pulled 9 G's.
Did that have anything to do with your back pain?
Probably. It probably did. And I'm not a G monster. I had to go through centrifuge multiple times. I did centrifuge for my initial F-18 training. And then when I started flying the F-16, I had to go back through centrifuge to do the 9G training. And that was very difficult for me because I freely admit I am not a G monster. Some people are just better at certain physical things than others. And my body is not super good at pulling G's naturally. I have a relatively low, I had a below average resting G tolerance. It was a lot of work for me to pass the 9G ride. And so after a while, not just from the back pain, but just from a safety standpoint, I did change how I flew the F-16 compared to how I flew the F-18. Because in the F-18, if I were to do a high-speed Immelmann, let's say, to come down from a higher altitude to attack somebody, I knew that I could bleed off a lot of my energy in the F-18 doing that procedure. But in the F-16, especially the way we flew them as adversaries with no fuel tanks, no pylons, you know, they did not want to bleed energy, especially with the relatively limited nose authority compared to the Hornet. They did not want to bleed energy. So a pure nose low vertical maneuver for me would put me at 9 Gs for an extended period of time. And that was something that I just wasn't comfortable doing. So I changed my technique to more of an oblique maneuver versus a pure vertical maneuver so that I could, I would always have the opportunity to scoop out that turn, or I could just do it at a lower G.
Keith, at the end of every episode of Pilot's Discretion, we always close with a lightning round we call Ready to Copy. So I'll throw out some questions on a bunch of different topics, and you give me your quick answer. You ready to copy?
Ready to copy.
What's a disqualifying condition that many pilots may not realize is disqualifying?
Sleep apnea.
Can I solve that with a special issuance medical, or is that an absolute stopper?
It's actually one of the easiest special issuance medicals you can probably get. And in fact, if you're under a proper treatment protocol, and you can show that to the AME, he should issue your certificate at the day of the exam, and you'll have 90 days to provide the paperwork to the FAA. What happens is you get people say, well, they didn't ask me about sleep apnea when they ask all those questions, but they do because there's a question that is other illness, disability, or surgery. So anything that's not specifically asked is supposed to go in that question. So, and then as long as your AME knows what they're doing, you should be able to get your certificate. And then you just have to provide the proper treatment paperwork after. But if you don't have the proper treatment and you don't have the paperwork, then it becomes a problem.
How about the opposite? What's a condition that is not disqualifying that many pilots think is? I still hear colorblindness once in a while. Oh, I'm colorblind. I can't be a pilot. And I have to tell people that I know many colorblind pilots out there.
Right. That is one that a lot of people, you're right. A lot of people do think that colorblindness is disqualifying. Now, there are levels of colorblindness, and that's the thing that a lot of people don't understand. And so the FAA does not require you to pass the color vision test perfectly. So you can have a mild color blindness and still pass and have no issues. And then even if you can't pass the normal color vision testing, you can do what's called a medical flight test. And so there's other steps involved, but there's a light test that you'll do with the PHYSDO. And if you can pass the light test, then you can try and do the medical flight test. And even still, even if you can't pass those, you can still be a daytime, pilot. You'll be limited to night and that kind of thing. But there are ways to get through it. It really only limits the people with pretty significant color blindness.
Basic Med is 6 years old now. One of the biggest innovations in general aviation aeromedical world in recent decades. How would you grade it as both a pilot and a doctor? A is a smashing success, F is a disaster. What letter grade would you give Basic Med?
I would probably give it a B+. And I would do that because the FAA had the opportunity to mold it into what they wanted. And I believe it was 2019 or maybe 2018 where I was very critical of the FAA panel at the Aerospace Medical Association, because this was right when, Basic Med was rolling out into, approval time. And there were a lot of people just bad mouthing it. And, so I asked them, I said, well, how much do you guys, take ownership for this being shoved down your throat by Congress because you did not work with AOPA and EAA? And, so this is what you got. They asked for help and you told them no. And the room got very quiet at that point. And I did point out that I was a pilot and a doctor and an AME. But overall, I think it does a good job. There are a few things that I think because the FAA medical department was not involved in, they would have liked to be different. And I think those things are probably valid. But overall, I think it's a great opportunity for folks who are pretty much exclusively recreational flying, and they have a very stable condition that is well managed. And so I do like that you have to get an FAA medical first, because you have to prove to the FAA that you are stable and well managed. And then your doctor has to assert that, yes, you continue to be stable and well managed. But it saves some economic side, right? So because going back to that John Travolta could fly any size airplane that he wants to pay for, there's a significantly greater risk associated with that. So because of that additional risk of any size aircraft, the FAA really wants to know that you're doing okay. But when you start shrinking the size of aircraft available via light sport or basic med, then the need to prove that in a detailed fashion that is over and above current medical standards kind of goes away. So I do like basic med.
If you could change one rule related to AMEs and pilot medicals, what would it be?
I think the 14-day submission requirement. So when you go to an AME, they only have 2 weeks to submit. So if you go to the AME and he notices, hey, you have a khaki condition, I need a note from your doctor. Well, you're unlikely to get that note in 14 days. But the AME is required to submit the exam to the FAA within 14 days. So that means you're deferred. Well, now that means that your case is probably taking 6 months. When if he could maybe have a little bit more time for you to get that note, you might get your medical in 3 to 4 weeks as opposed to 6 months.
There's a lot of confusion about over-the-counter drugs and what are allowed and what aren't. What's a big offender for you, something that a lot of pilots take that may not realize it's not approved?
Basically anything for sleep. And when I say anything for sleep, Benadryl is included in that. So the generic diphenhydramine is a component of many over-the-counter sleep aids, such as not NyQuil, because that uses alcohol, actually. But many other, like Tylenol PM and many other over-the-counter sleep aids contain Benadryl. And Benadryl is highly sedating. In fact, if you take Benadryl because you actually need it for something, let's say you were in the hospital for a severe allergic reaction, they give you Benadryl, there's a minimum 5-day wait period before you can fly after taking Benadryl because it is so sedating. And again, you may feel fine after a day or two until the oxygen drops off and the cognitive demand increases, and then you might find yourself not quite 100%. So Benadryl is probably the leading, you know, most dangerous accidental sedating medication. And then the NTSB did a study a while ago, I think it was 2017 was the result. 28% of pilots in fatal accidents had a potentially impairing medication, whether it's over-the-counter, illicit, or prescription in their system.
Yeah, that's an amazing study. I remember that one as well, that even if you think some of their numbers are off, it's a big number. It should make us all think. Is there a habit from your pilot training days that translated to your medical training? Something that as you approach the medical world, you said, oh, this is just like pilot training.
There are remarkable similarities from being a pilot and being a doctor, but the training is wildly different. They're both very much apprenticeship style training, but whereas pilot training, you kind of know this is the lesson I'm due for. These are the things I'm expected to know in this lesson. That's not really how medicine goes. Medicine is rarely like that. Like you might have an area that you're studying, but you show up at the hospital and you get whatever patients show up and the doctors will ask you any question. So that part was different, but the part that is the same is the kind of the small teams, right? Especially in military flying where you have your air crew, you might have a co-pilot, you have your controllers, your combat controllers, you have your ground crew that preps your airplane. So you have a relatively small crew, your wingman, and they're mostly pretty motivated people. Well, in medicine, it's kind of the same. You have your nurses, you have your physician assistants, you have your pharmacists, you got the other doctors on your team, and most of them are pretty motivated people. So that part is very similar. And then the other part is that things are constantly changing. And if you want to keep learning, there's a never-ending, you know, fountain of information out there, and you just have to go look for it.
As someone who has flown at Top Gun, do you enjoy the movies or are they painful to watch?
So I saw the first movie, I believe I was 9 when the first movie came out. And it was either the same year or the very next year that I went to my first air show. The combination of those two things set me on the path of, I got to be a fighter pilot. And so looking back at the first movie now, I still love the first movie now, but the second movie is actually quite fantastic. And I actually know some of the people who were technical advisors on the film, and they did a really good job with making the mission and showing the training. Now, obviously, some things are Hollywood. You don't fly that close formation, and certain things that they did would be way too dangerous in the real world. But they did a fantastic job of showing the average person what it's like to fly in those types of aircraft.
Is Top Gun your favorite aviation flying aviation movie? Is it Iron Eagle, Flight of the Intruder? Give us your favorite military flying movie.
So Top Gun Maverick is my favorite now. Yep. Flight of the Intruder was probably pretty high up there as well. Iron Eagle was great when I was a kid. That was a really old, you know, when you're a kid and here's this teenager who was, you know, 4 years older than you jumping in an F-16 flying around. That was amazing. But that one doesn't hold up quite as well over time.
I had a similar experience. Watched that after 20 years off and it did not hold up really at all. Keith, our last question is always the same on this podcast. You have one final flight. We want to know, what are you flying and where are you going?
Well, probably flying my Bonanza A36, and I'm going to take my kids. And the funny part is, it's the act of getting them to the airport and getting through the FBO to the airplane that is the most fun, because they are so wildly excited to go fly. And then once you're actually flying, they're just, you know, sitting on their iPads.
Keith, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion, brought to you by Sporties, training and equipping pilots worldwide for over 60 years. For more episodes and today's show links, visit sporties.com/podcast. I'm John Zimmerman. We'll see you next time on Pilot's Discretion.